This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. This week, we look at ways to alleviate world hunger, from farming in the desert to farming in the slums. That's Gloria. She's one of the solutions. She lives in the crowded city of Kampala, sharing cramped quarters with chickens, crops, and a million people trying to feed themselves. And we'll hear music from Khaled, an African exile living in France. France has been a mecca for refugees for years. Nobody under 18 can be deported, so children often end up there, living on the streets.
Here the boys look out for each other. They even cut each other's hair. The boys line up as a friend stands over them one by one, snipping here and there, cutting away the matted results of months on the road.
Stick around as we take you around the world with the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. First, this hour's news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In September, France tore down a sprawling shantytown on the outskirts of Calais. It was home to about 1,000 illegal migrants. Most of them were from Afghanistan, and all were trying to get to the UK by sneaking rides on ferries that crossed the English Channel. French authorities say they destroyed the makeshift camp, known as the jungle, because the number of migrants was growing, and so was crime. TV reporters were there when the bulldozers moved in and the shacks came down.
It was home, but no more. Heavy machinery removes the final traces of the jungle, one of Europe's most controversial immigration sites.
Many of the migrants who lived in the jungle fled. Immigration officials took the rest into custody. But for the children, it was a different story. Don Duncan explains.
In France, it is illegal to deport anyone under 18. And it's even illegal to detain minors. Sylvia Copions is with a migrant advocacy group called Salam.
All the minors were sent to juvenile centers after the destruction of the jungle, some as far as 150 kilometers away. But they were free to leave whenever, and they did. They fled back here, to Calais.
So now minors who've traveled to France alone are roaming the streets of downtown Calais in a kind of nightmarish version of Neverland. Boys, some as young as 12 and mostly from Afghanistan, have taken refuge under its bridges and in its parks. 17-year-old Wahid Ula is one of them.
Where do you live now?
Here.
Where do you sleep?
Here, this place.
This place is a refuse-ridden section of a canal bank that's no longer in use. Here the boys look out for each other, helping to find food and build shelter with what refuse they can find. Plastic sheeting, carpet and cardboard. They even cut each other's hair. The boys line up as a friend stands over them one by one, snipping here and there, cutting away the matted results of months on the road. Every day at 2 p.m., a soup van run by the refugee aid organization Salam pulls up to the canal and volunteers hand out thick soup, baguettes and coffee. The organization also provides clothing and health care. 15-year-old Rahim Hazar Boaz, dressed in a sky blue hoodie and soiled jeans, has just had a hand bandaged by the Salam volunteers. He says he hurt it in the jungle, but he seems too scared to explain what exactly happened. The jungle was dangerous, he says, but now that it's gone, he is separated from many of the adult migrants who used to look out for him.
Here, no facilities, nothing. We are living in the park. Side of rock, no shelter. If it is rain, what should we do here? We are not animals, we are human.
The situation is rough, but these children have seen much worse while in the grips of the human smugglers that brought them here from Afghanistan.
If you don't walk, they will shoot you. You have to go fast. If you don't climb on the mountain, they will shoot you.
Rahim's parents paid for him to be smuggled here. They had hoped he'd find a job and have a better future than he would in Afghanistan. The smugglers moved him through Iran, Turkey, Greece, Italy and France by truck, ferry and on foot. Sometimes he went for days without food. The journey to France can cost between $10,000 and $15,000. 15-year-old Wahid is paying his own way. He says his parents were killed by the Taliban and he had to sell off the family holdings to pay his way out of danger.
My father worked with American and Taliban came and killed him. I fled away from Afghanistan and came to European country to save my life.
fact often blurs with fiction along the illegal migrant routes crisscrossing the world. On their route, these children learn they will need a solid story of political or religious persecution to stand any chance of getting asylum in the UK. But regardless of the authenticity of their stories, one thing is indisputable. They are underage, alone in Calais, and very vulnerable. Back on the canal bank, the children sit in clusters, sipping their soup and biting lumps off their crusty bread. Like many here, Rahim hasn't given up the dream of making it to Great Britain.
We get to the UK, just I'm going to school, come back from school, I want to be educated. Oh, I know the government will help me.
As Rahim tells me this, I notice that some of the boys have saved their bananas for later, when they will try once again to sneak onto a truck and head to the UK. For the World Vision Report, I'm Don Duncan in Calais, France.
Winter is quickly approaching and it's getting cold on the streets of Calais. We wanted an update on how the children are managing, so we called William Spindler. He's with the United Nations Refugee Agency and he's based in Paris. William, we just heard Don's story about the Afghani children who are living on the streets of Calais. Can you update us on what's happening with them now?
Yes, the weather is getting cold. They are living in unsanitary conditions. Also, we are worried that they might fall prey to human traffickers. Particularly in the case of small children, this is very worrying. It's really a sight that breaks your heart when you see children that can be as young as 10 or 11 sleeping in the streets.
I see. And I'm wondering, some of these refugee children do manage to get into the United Kingdom, but what happens when they arrive there? Are they treated any better than they are in France? Do they have better living situations there, really?
The reception system in both countries is similar in the sense that the accommodation is provided for asylum seekers in France. The problem is that many of these children fall through the cracks of the system. Either they are not willing to claim asylum in France because they don't want to stay in France, or they find it difficult to do so because of bureaucratic rules. But to answer your question, when some of them manage to get across, and this is very difficult, some of them do apply for asylum in the UK, but most of them, in fact, simply disappear among the Afghan communities in big cities such as Birmingham. There is a support system provided by their own communities.
And I'm wondering what the sentiment is among the public in France. Do they want the government to take these children in? Do they think other countries in the European Union ought to be taking their share? Or is there even any empathy at all?
I think it's fair to say that public opinion in France is on the whole sympathetic to these children. But the government is very reluctant to do anything to improve the situation because they are afraid that this will make more people come to Calais. And therefore, they are very reluctant for any kind of permanent shelter to be built or provided for these people. But in the long run, as long as you have conflict, serious human rights violations, lack of governance, you will have people desperately enough to undertake these long and dangerous journeys to find a better life.
And as you say, it's unlikely to stop, especially as conflicts increase in these countries.
Yes. At the same time, we are hopeful because we have seen in the past that after conflicts have come to an end, people have been able to return home. And in Europe in the past, we had hundreds of thousands of refugees from countries in the Balkans, for instance, who have returned to the countries once peace arrived there. In the case of Afghanistan, which at the moment seems to be the source of many of these children, we saw a large return of refugees after the fall of the Taliban. But we've seen that now that the situation in Afghanistan is deteriorating again, people are beginning to leave in large numbers again. And those who are returning, in fact, are the minority.
It wouldn't seem safe to send these children back in any way. I mean, going back to Afghanistan would not be a solution.
Well, in the case of France, French law prohibits that they are sent back to Afghanistan, but that applies only for those who are under 18.
This is obviously a very complicated and sticky issue. What is the United Nations Refugee Agency proposing as a solution?
The UN Refugee Agency works specifically with people who are fleeing persecution and war. So concretely, what we're doing in Calais is offering information and counseling to those people who we think might be in a position to claim asylum in France. To a large extent, the problem has been created because of internal rules that say that people should apply for asylum in the first country where they arrive. But in many cases, people might have a very good reason why they want to apply for asylum in a different country. And we're asking the European Union to look into this problem. But our position is not that countries should receive every single person who wants to come here. We realize that immigration is not a right, that governments have the right to have their own immigration policy and decide who comes here and who doesn't. But what we're saying is that here we have people who are leaving the country not because they want to improve their life, but because they want to save their life. They are people who are escaping persecution because of their political views, because of their religion, and these people are in danger if they are sent back. So in this case, European governments have the obligation to receive these people and provide protection. And in case of doubt, people should be given the benefit of the doubt, because the consequences of somebody being sent to a country where they could be persecuted could be very serious, in some cases fatal. So we can't afford to make that sort of mistake.
William Spindler, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
William Spindler is with the United Nations Refugee Agency. He spoke to us from Paris. And by the way, Don Duncan, who filed the report on the Children of the Jungle refugee camp, has written a blog about the jungle and immigration issues. It's on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Hi, I'm Ishma Fundikwa, Global Music Guide for the World Vision Report. As we've just heard, France has been a mecca for immigrants from all over the world, including musicians from Africa. One of the most popular and successful African artists, who is now based in France and has done very well internationally, is Algeria's Khaled. Here he is with one of his biggest hits, Didi. That was Didi by Khaled, which, though it dates back to the early 1990s, is still a dance floor favorite. I'm Ish Mafundikwa.
Coming up, food. We take a look at the lack of it, the taste of it, and how to cook it. Next on the World Vision Report. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. It could have offered real solutions to global hunger. Instead, the recent UN Summit on Food Security in Rome is being called a failure. That's because wealthy countries made vague promises, but no real commitments to increase food assistance to the hungry. Meanwhile, the number of people who are hungry and need food right now is higher than ever. A new book called Millions Fed might offer some solutions to the crisis. David Spielman with the International Food Policy Research Institute is one of its editors.
After about two decades of neglect, decision makers are really recognizing now the central importance of agriculture for development, or agriculture as an engine of growth. The importance of agricultural development has been reaffirmed by the G20 nations, who recently committed an additional $22 billion for agriculture.
Spielman's book contains 20 case studies about projects that have been successful in increasing food production. We'll be talking about some of them in the upcoming weeks, but we start by looking at one project, the Greening of the Sahel. That's the area at the southern edge of the Sahara Desert.
The Sahel is a very arid region, Burkina Faso, Niger, Mali. It's very dry. Farmers they grow millet, sorghum, and they keep goats and sheep and other small livestock. Most farmers are dependent on rainfall. There's no real irrigation to speak of. And life is constantly threatened by drought.
Why were things there getting worse?
There were several droughts, a series of droughts, back in the 1970s and the 1980s. And a number of large-scale government projects to develop irrigation and other types of infrastructure to improve farming had basically failed.
And what you found is that there were some solutions, and some small-scale farmers were actually able to turn things around. How did that happen?
Well, beginning in about the 1980s, community groups and community leaders in the area recognized that they had a problem on their hands. And they set about to develop and reinvigorate traditional practices for the management of soil, water, forests, crops, and livestock. This happened in the central plateau of Burkina Faso and in the southern area of Niger. And these efforts, with the support of non-governmental organizations and scientists and others, led to the rehabilitation of more than 5 million hectares of farmland between the two countries, which between the 1980s and today has produced enough food to sustain about 3 million additional people in the region. And that's a real success.
Hmm. So you say they revived some traditional methods. Can you describe what some of those methods are that made, I guess, the soil so much different?
Sure. One of the interesting interventions that communities invested in Burkina Faso were these zai holes. And essentially what they are deep pits that catch rainwater, and they can collect soil runoff and organic manure and other types of materials that are good for planting, that are good for plants. And by doing that, you can plant sorghum, millet, and other types of crops that people subsist on in that region and improve your yields and your production year on year. There were the construction of stone bunds. Those are, you know, short stone walls that you lay across fields along the lines of where rainfall and water flow, so that you capture soil runoff and you capture water when it does rain in the Sahel. And that residual moisture, that water, makes a big difference to helping plants grow.
So if that's a traditional method, I can't help but wonder why they ever left it for something that wasn't working well.
That's a good question, and there are lots of reasons why they might have. In some cases, it could have been labor shortages, people migrating out, losing the knowledge. In other cases, it could have been, you know, that large government schemes attempted to surpass these traditional methods of managing soil and water and forests. So there are lots of different reasons.
And we're talking about a region, again, that's very dry, the southern edge of the Sahara Desert. Are there any lessons to be learned from what they're learning there by reviving these traditional methods? I mean, can what these farmers have done be actually spread to other regions in the developing world?
Absolutely. And there are many examples in the developing world where indigenous knowledge, indigenous technologies, local knowledge have been put to the test and have helped make a difference in food security. This happens to be one of the biggest successes, if you will. And we're, you know, like I said, we're talking about more than 5 million hectares and enough food to sustain 3 million people between these two countries. Indigenous knowledge is a very powerful driver of change. And community involvement in agricultural development is also a very powerful driver of change.
David Spielman, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
David Spielman is a fellow with the International Food Policy Research Institute. He spoke to us from Washington. In the next few weeks, we'll bring you more examples of agricultural success stories from Spielman's new book, Millions Fed. Governments and aid agencies will continue debating how to solve the world's hunger problem. Meanwhile, people have to live and eat, and some have come up with their own way of making sure there's enough food for the family each day. Michelle Betts reports from Kampala, Uganda.
Until a few years ago, Harriet Nankya Kizito was a crop farmer, growing cassava, tomatoes, and sweet potatoes on several acres of rented land here on the outskirts of Kampala. But as Kampala grew, the land value grew with it, and the owners began selling. Harriet suddenly found herself forced to find another way to take care of her husband and five kids.
As land became scarce, I started saving money to buy the chicks. And as land dwindled more, I concentrated on raising chickens.
Now Harriet raises several hundred chicks on her own 1 acre of land. She buys them when they're 1 day old, and 7 weeks later she sells them for about $2 each. The biggest advantage to this new venture? No need for a lot of land. She keeps the chicks in a small shed next to her house.
These chickens have changed our life. My husband is not employed, but with these chicks, I'm able to look after the family and the kids' requirements for school.
While she's clearly thrilled with her chickens, Harriet also insists on introducing Gloria.
This is Gloria. This is her first pregnancy. The other is Rita, the mother, and she's pregnant too.
The two dairy cows stay penned up most of the time. One of her kids takes them to their neighbor's land to graze in exchange for chicks or milk. The cows provide milk for the family, plus some extra to sell at market. Harriet says being forced to change the way she farms has brought more than financial benefits.
Now that I'm getting older, it's great to be able to work from my home because it's not as exhausting. In that way, raising chicks has changed my life. I have a better quality of life.
Close to half of Kampala's 1.2 million people practice some form of urban farming, be it a small subsistence vegetable patch or a few cows or chickens in their yards of usually an acre or less. Many city farmers seem to be magicians at utilizing tiny spaces. Jelly Nalubega lives here, in the middle of a slum just outside Kampala's center. Jolly, a 50-something woman with graying eyebrows, points to a small dark doorway at the end of her one-room house. I poke my head in. The enclosure is too small to fit two people, yet this is where Jolly makes her living.
Instead of keeping that space wasted,
it's better to at least have this project.
That space is the 3 feet between her house and her neighbor's, which Jolly has covered with plastic and pieces of wood. And the project? Mushrooms. I count around 80 basketball-sized black plastic-covered lumps hanging from 4 long wooden poles. White oyster mushrooms sprout from the plastic. Jolly used to have a small general shop, but gave it up when she realized she could make more money growing mushrooms.
So I found that mushroom is better. My weekly income.
I found that mushrooms are better. My weekly income, if I produce 8 or 10 kilos, is about 30,000.
Yes.
30,000 Ugandan shillings. That's about 16 US dollars a week. Not bad in a country where the average income is only $5 a week. But city officials have concerns about urban farming. They say some crops are grown in wetlands, once used as dumping grounds for human and other waste. They worry that heavy metals in the soil could make their way into vegetables grown there. And some neighbors complain about the smell and the dust that accompanies some types of livestock and other farming. What do Jolly the mushroom farmer's neighbors think of her enterprise?
My neighbors.
My neighbors?
I'm supplying them
with mushrooms.
They are happy with that.
Jolly says she'll keep growing mushrooms as long as she makes money. Her goal? To buy a small plot of land and move out of the slum. For the World Vision Report, I'm Michelle Betts in Kampala, Uganda.
In some places, it's not access to food that's the issue, it's the taste of food. Reporter Will Everett was recently in Senegal, where he discovered that a small packet of flavoring is changing the eating habits of a whole country. Here's Will's reporter's notebook.
You can't travel in Senegal without seeing the logo for a popular food additive everywhere. There are TV ads for Maggi, touting it as a powder that can transform the blandest of meals. Billboards depict a grinning housewife stirring a pot, and the caption, "A little of this and your husband's gonna love you tonight." Whole storefronts are painted in the iconic yellow and red Maggi colors, with signs telling you, "Maggi sold here." I noticed that even my bed sheets at the guest house were emblazoned with the Maggi logo. Maggi comes in sizes ranging from 1-inch cubes to 20-pound buckets. I watched the guest house cook sprinkle a little on my rice dish one evening. You know the little flavor packets that come with ramen noodles? Maggi tastes a little like that. Salty, spicy, and sort of fake. And everyone seems to be using it. It's been sold for a long time, but in the last 2 or 3 years, Maggi's popularity has exploded, thanks to aggressive marketing. Once in a rural village, I asked a doctor at the local hospital what was up with this stuff. How did it become so popular? And was it healthy? Dr. So said Maggi was killing his people.
It's full of MSG and sodium, and it really causes a lot of trouble for people, you know. We see many people are having hypertension now. Coronary artery disease are very common. Obesity is increasing, especially among the women.
Dr. So said Maggi is so popular that people feel a kind of social obligation to make it available at the table.
If you have a visitor, if you have a guest, if you don't provide for him or for them such food, you feel like you brought shame to the family. So you have to bring the most spiciest things you can afford.
He remembered that the meals he ate decades ago were rich in grains and vegetables. But nowadays people eat mostly rice, sometimes with fish. And for families too poor to afford fish, Maggi is on hand to make the bland palatable. Dr. So says that when he's out making his rounds and families offer to cook for him, he asks for the kind of meals his grandmother used to make.
I visit people in the villages, you know, at least maybe twice, three times a month. And whenever I go, they're surprised if I tell them the food that I want them to cook for me. Some of them, they don't believe I'm serious in that, you know, and I'm really serious.
That afternoon, he took me to visit a family living near the hospital. We stayed for lunch, and as we sat in a circle on the ground, a covered aluminum bowl was placed before us. When the lid came off, Dr. So glanced up and gave me a knowing smile. It was a simple dish of rice and fish in a rich dark sauce. It was flavored with onions, pepper, and natural seasonings, or so the cook assured us. I couldn't resist glancing into the kitchen later to see for myself. And sure enough, there it was, a red and yellow box of Maggi on a shelf above the stove.
Will Everett is a freelance reporter based in Texas.
We're going to start with some olive oil in a hot pot.
You take your corn and you get as much of the silk as you can off.
Here in the U.S., TV cooking shows are pretty popular. But for some people, learning basic kitchen skills does more than make them into a good cook. The World Vision Report's Cynthia Graber has more.
It's class time at Fair Start, a cooking school in downtown Seattle. A handful of students stand at various stations. One guy holds a carrot in one hand and his peeler in the other. He's about to be tested on his speed.
On your mark, get set, go. Move a little faster, Kelly.
Fair Start began back in 1987 when local chef David Lee started delivering meals to homeless shelters. But 5 years later, he had an epiphany. Lee is no longer head of the program, so Megan Karch, Fair Start's current director, picks up the story.
He realized that while it was very important to provide meals to people in need, perhaps it was even more important to provide a way out. And so that's how we were founded, was on bringing the folks that he was providing the meals to into the kitchen, teaching them a job skill, and then ultimately giving them the opportunity to change their life through a job.
You got your carrots?
These homeless students aren't learning to be top chefs. That would take many years at a culinary school. But graduates can work as line or prep cooks on cruise ships, in assisted living kitchens, or in local restaurants. Until the recession hit, the program managed to help 80% of graduates find jobs within only a few months. Today, it's taking a little longer. In addition to 4 months of cooking classes, Fair Start helps students find a bed in a local shelter or a halfway house. They also receive health and job counseling. In exchange, they agree to stay clean and sober. After students learn the basics, they work with teachers on preparing food to bring to shelters and child care centers around the city. Last year, Fair Start gave away 500,000 meals made and delivered by their students. Jeff, he doesn't want his last name used, is one of them.
It's kind of a fun thing, and it's kind of a neat thing, because they're helping us out, and we're helping somebody else out.
But there's one place here where students get the best kitchen training possible, in Fair Start's very own restaurant. Its expansive windows look onto a busy street corner in downtown Seattle. The dining room has exposed wood, lofty ceilings, and white tablecloths. Every day, people from neighboring businesses come in for a reasonably priced, top-quality lunch. Dinner's only served on Thursdays, when the restaurant offers a prefix meal planned by a guest chef and cooked by a few of the most advanced students. Tonight, the guest chef is Michael White from Seattle's Brasserie Margaux.
And then the entree is a roasted leg of lamb, young spring lamb, and it's going to be sliced. It's going to be on a bed of grilled squashes, zucchini and yellow squash, and also some red bell peppers. And then we're going to do a mold of wild rice pilaf.
Chef White brought his assistant from his own restaurant to help out, a line cook named Ken Kelly. Kelly's been working at Brasserie Margaux for a year, and he's a graduate of Fair Start.
If you don't like the end that's on that, cut it off.
Ken strides confidently around the kitchen, calling out directions. He was jobless and homeless after a brief stint in prison. He heard about Fair Start and decided to give it a try. He says the program gave him just what he needed, a fair start, and he loved it.
A lot of the techniques were new to me. You know, I'm a devout carnivore, so I had to learn how to cook vegetables. And I've actually found that I can cook vegetables that I like.
Ken got the job with Brasserie Margaux right after he graduated.
Employers like the one I went to work with would not have talked to me if it wasn't for Fair Start and the community support that it has. Nobody looked down on me. Nobody avoided me. And I've worked really hard to prove myself worth being there. I am a lot happier on the days when I have to go to work than the days when I don't.
As dinner draws to a close, Fair Start director Megan Karch stands on the stairway, mic in hand. Each week, the new graduates get to tell a bit of their stories. And tonight, two women are graduating, one of whom already has a job at a local restaurant. But first...
And we also, it is a very special night because one of our graduates is back with Brasserie Margaux teaching our students.
Ken Kelly stood here a year ago as a graduate. Now he beams from the stairs as he accepts the Fair Start hat and water bottle that the guest chefs receive. For the World Vision Report, I'm Cynthia Graber in Seattle.
Helping Restaviks in Haiti. That's next on the World Vision Report. Stay with us. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. In Haiti, thousands of children live in slavery. They're known as Restaviks. In French, that means to stay with. Originally, the word referred to children who'd gone to live with other families, to work as au pairs, or to help around the house. In return, they'd be able to go to school and live a better life. But in reality, that's not how it's working. Joan Kahn is one of the founders of an organization called Restavek Freedom.
It basically means that children are in domestic servitude, and they do all the domestic chores in the home, children as young as five.
Where do they find these children who do these chores for them?
These children come from rural communities primarily, and people will come and they'll ask parents, or parents will freely give them over. And then now there also has become another element to this, where you have people known as coutiers that will go into these areas and they'll request these children. They'll be given these children, and oftentimes they will go and sell them to people in the cities.
Why would a parent give up a child?
Many times they're giving up these children because they really think they're doing something good for the child, because they can't feed them. Most often there aren't schools in a lot of the rural communities, so they can't educate them. They feel like they might be able to give this child an opportunity in the city.
And how many of these children are there in Haiti right now?
Well, an estimate was done several years ago by UNICEF, which estimated these children to be around 300,000, but we honestly feel like it's much higher than 300,000.
Some might consider slaves an extreme word. Is slaves the right word for these kids?
I'm not sure what else you would call it. If you go by the definition that Free the Slaves actually coined, these children aren't chained. but they are psychologically bound. And they are held with the threat of violence. They aren't paid anything. And they really have nowhere to go. So when people say, why don't these kids run away to what?
Why don't they run back to their parents and tell them, hey, this isn't what you thought it was?
Well, because oftentimes they don't have the means to get back to their parents. And sometimes they can't do that because the parents expect them to stay there.
And the parents don't come visit them or stay in touch with the families to make sure their kids are okay?
Sometimes they do. But oftentimes the children won't tell the parents what's going on with them.
What is going on? You and your husband and your organization go into these areas, into the cities, and find these children. What do you see? What is a typical story?
Well, a typical story would be a child that comes from a rural community. Typically, the children, they like to get them around 8 because then they can carry heavier loads and they work. And most people like to get girls instead of boys because the boys oftentimes will run away and become, you see many more boys on the streets than you do girls. But these children might start their day at 4:30, 5 o'clock. They wake up, they empty all the bedpans, they'll make the coffee, they'll cook the breakfast, they'll do the shopping, they'll clean the house. Oftentimes they'll walk the other children to school carrying their backpacks. Many times these kids are not allowed to go to school.
How do they compare with the other kids in these families where they work?
Typically they get the scraps off the table, or they might get what's left at the bottom of the pot. I think the worst thing for these kids, and they will even tell you, is not often the beatings, it's the isolation. Because they know they don't belong. That's not their home. And so they never have a sense of belonging to anything. They're not allowed to speak unless spoken to. And then for minor infractions, if they're late coming back from the market, they get beaten. Oftentimes these kids are also sexually abused. They're borrowed by their neighbors to do household chores for the neighbors if they don't have their own child.
What is it about the Haitian culture that lends itself to using other people's children as slaves and treating them virtually like dogs?
I don't know. All I know is the cruelty there is beyond comprehension. And I think it is a part of the culture. It's a part of the culture that's been embedded there. And I think the only way that they can treat these children this way is to not bond with them. If you bonded with something, with a child, you're going to love that child. You're going to treat that child differently. So in order not to see these children as human, there's no bonding that ever takes place there.
Your organization goes in and really, you're trying to stop this using of children as slaves, and you rescue some of these Restaviks. You've reunited them with some of their families, but you also, what else do you do with these kids once you get them out of the homes?
Well, we don't always get them out of the homes. We're trying to work with the people where these children live to get them to see these children differently. We will encourage them to send them to school, and if they agree, we'll pay their tuition, we'll buy their books, and we buy their uniforms. And then oftentimes when they see you investing in this child, they begin to treat the child differently.
Why don't you all take them out of these homes?
Well, there's over 300,000, and if we took them out of the homes, I'm not sure we'd be able to place all these children.
Would their parents not take them back?
We have worked from that aspect a couple of times, and it's a difficult situation because you really need to go meet with the parent before you try to reunite the child, because we did that one time and it was not a good situation, and we did it another time and it was a good situation. The family was very happy to have their daughter back, and we've been back since to see if she was still there, and she is, but it doesn't often always work out that way. It's very difficult because the roads are really bad in Haiti. They're in rural areas. It can take 9 hours just to get to a child's home. And that doesn't keep you from doing it. It's just hard to find the child, and the parents, and locate their families. If we ever have any parent that contacts us and says, I want to find my child, we'll help them find their child.
So basically what you do is try to work with the families who keep them as slaves?
We're trying to work on 4 different platforms. One is the victim, which is the child. And basically, when we do get these children in school, we have child advocates. They go in and they listen to these children. Now, the difficult part is when you listen to these kids and they tell you some of the things that are going on with them, and then you send them back into that situation. So our goal is to build a transitional home. And with that, we can pull the worst cases out. We will never be able to pull every case out. But we're also working with the government to try to get the government to pass some laws.
Are there no laws? Is this not illegal?
No. This was a system in some ways like an au pair system, where people used to send their kids to wealthier relatives in the city so that they would have a better chance and better opportunity. Well, it's not ended up being that same system anymore.
When you find these children and you meet them or sit down to talk to them, what are they like?
They don't look at you. They hold their head down unless you tell them, you know, look at me, because they've been told they can't look at adults in the eye. There's no joy on their face, and there's not much you can say that will make them smile or laugh. And one little girl that we interviewed, and we always ask them, we ask these kids, what are your hopes and dreams? And this little girl looked at us and she said, I just want to be human.
That was Joan Kahn, founder of Restivik Freedom. You can find out more about Restiviks and about the organization on our website, worldvisionreport.org.
Hello, Ishma Fundikwa here again. I'm the guide to global music for the World Vision Report. When you talk about Haiti, the first musician that comes to mind is Wyclef Jean. Although he has made it big as a hip-hop artist, Wyclef, who's now based in Brooklyn, New York City, has not forgotten his Haitian roots. Here's the man and the track MVP Compa, done in the Haitian style known as Compa Direct. That was Wyclef Jean with the song MVP Compa. Wyclef is scheduled to perform at the Nobel Peace Prize concert on December 11 in Oslo. I'm Ishma Fundikwa, and you are listening to the World Vision Report.
In Nigeria, the idea of taking in a child who's not part of your family is considered taboo. So abandoned or orphaned children often end up on the streets, unless they find their way to Christiana George. The former businesswoman started an orphanage and a campaign to promote adoption in Nigeria. Sarah Simpson brings us her story.
Some 20 years ago, Christiana George had a relatively well-paid job in a top Nigerian bank. Life was good, she says, with a husband and three children. But, as the 53-year-old describes it, a spiritual awakening led her to invest her time in helping the less fortunate.
Before then, I was one of those that believed that everything was by luck, and that if you're poor, then that's your luck. If you're rich, it's your luck, you know. But after that, I realized that it's the grace of God, you know. If someone is poor, it's not by their choosing.
Right from the start, George decided to focus on children, work she now describes as her calling.
Children, you know, are the most vulnerable in the chain of poverty. And I felt that, look, the only way I can help Nigeria for the future is to help the children.
She decided to help 25 orphaned kids and used her own money to set up Lagos's first private orphanage called Little Saints. Child abandonment happens all too frequently in Lagos, where extreme poverty can lead to extreme choices. So, as word of her project spread, people began bringing abandoned babies to her for care.
The first abandoned child we named Mary, and she was actually brought by the policewoman in a cellophane bag, And that's the way she was abandoned, by the dustbin. We took her out, washed her, and fed her, and she was such a beautiful child.
A small but welcoming room is filled with babies, cots and toys, and there's an army of young women, some volunteers, some employed here, coddling and cooing over the kids. The baby unit is one of four Little Saints homes, which together care for over 100 children at any one time. All depend on private donations of cash, food, and even baby clothes. On the wall, George talks me through a pinboard filled with photos of children who passed through the unit over the years. For each child, there is a picture taken on arrival and one later on, the before and after, so to speak.
Okay, that's the state in which we receive some of them sometimes.
So how old would they be?
Many of the arrival pictures are shocking. Images of tiny, emaciated children stare out of the photographs with haunted eyes. But with a few weeks of love and care, their cheeks become chubby and full, their eyes bright and alert.
This is Esther.
So how old is Esther?
Esther would be about...
Little Saint's most recent arrival is Esther. She arrived just days ago after her mother, who was living under a bridge in Lagos, died.
In hospital, she said to us, "Look, I know I'm going to die, but please, can you look for my daughters?"
A volunteer tries to get Esther interested in a rattle. Another volunteer here today is a former Little Saints orphan herself. Buki Falade George is now 22. Buki was never adopted, but grew up here. She took George's surname as her own and considers George her mum.
She's been a wonderful person to me. She's been a blessing to me, and not only me, and my older sisters, they've gone to school. So it's really wonderful staying with her. You know, I grew up with her. So she's full of compassion, full of love.
Ideally, George doesn't want to be mum to all the hundreds of kids that pass through Little Saints. So some years ago, she began promoting adoption. The going was tough at first. She had to work hard to get the word out.
We went to the churches. We wrote letters to community leaders, you know, just to spread the word that there are beautiful babies in Little Saints Orphanage for adoption. You know, they began to trickle in, you know, one by one. But the good news today is I actually have a waiting list of couples who want to adopt.
Always on the lookout to do more, George says she now wants to encourage more foster parenting in a bid to get older street kids into homes with loving families. For the World Vision Report, I'm Sarah Simpson in Lagos, Nigeria.
In Azerbaijan, hospitality is highly valued. Guests are welcomed at any time of day, and they're always offered the best food, best seating, or sleeping arrangements. At least, that's what Carla Seidel tells us. She spent 27 months in the East European country as a Peace Corps volunteer. Here's her aid worker diary.
Whenever I showed up at an Azerbaijani home, I would be greeted with a hearty welcome. I spent hours at different families' houses drinking several cups of hot tea, regardless of season. And I ate meals made from the best ingredients that the family could afford, often involving the slaughter of a chicken from their own yard. But in Azerbaijani culture, the guest has certain responsibilities. For instance, if you are invited to someone's house at a specified day and time, you accept whether you want to or not. Work and errands come after maintaining personal relationships. I remember one time, during my first year in the country, my host sister and I had spent several hours preparing dishes for another American volunteer coming over to visit. We were just setting the table when we got a phone call from our guest. She couldn't make it. She was busy studying. My host sister was appalled. "I'm used to people canceling on me like this in America," I told her. "Well, here," she explained, "if someone does this, it's the end of the relationship." Azerbaijanis are prepared for guests at all times. The Azerbaijani home, often one-third the size of an American one, usually has a tall, carefully stacked pile of hand-stuffed mattresses on hand for guests. I remember traveling with my host sister to a relative's wedding in the capital city of Baku one weekend. When we reached her cousin's apartment, we saw that it was already full of guests, but we were warmly welcomed all the same. In order to sleep, older visitors were given the bed and couch, and the rest of us, including the hosts, packed together on the handmade mattresses that covered nearly every inch of available floor space. Soon after having returned to the U.S., I was traveling through a nearby city and needed a place to stay one night. A relative apologized for not being able to put me up. Part of her home was being redone. A close friend said that she was too busy to see me. Maybe in a month or so, things would settle down and she could squeeze me in. After over 2 years away, I found that catching up with other friends would involve an overpriced coffee or a meal at a restaurant jammed into a busy day of errands and work commitments. When the bill came, we scanned the prices to determine whose salad or cappuccino was more expensive and divided up the costs accordingly. America may have higher income and productivity levels, a better functioning democracy, more orderly, efficient systems, and more just institutions, but it seems that something has been lost along the way. Alone now in my home country, I sigh and, despite the summer heat, sit down to sip my cup of hot tea.
Carla Seidel lives in Huntington, New York, but she's just left for her new Peace Corps assignment in Togo. And that's it for this week. Remember, our show is on the web. You can download a podcast if you want to take us with you. The address? worldvisionreport.org. You can follow us on Twitter, and you can become a fan of the World Vision Report on Facebook, where you can get a sneak peek of our upcoming show Friday afternoons. The program is produced by Beverly Abel and edited by Diane Toomey. Lita Hartman is the assignment editor. Christina Darden, Cynthia Graber, and Sue Shepard are our producers. Chris Baldig is our production assistant. Doug Boyles is our audio engineer. Emily Eagle is our engineering assistant. And I'm Peggy Wehmeyer.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization. I'm not going to be able to do it.